Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, to this function which the Sydney Institute is doing with the Eisenhower Foundation, and I ask Meredith Hellicker, representing the Eisenhower Foundation, to introduce our speaker. Meredith, thank you.
Thanks, Jared, and thanks so much to the Sydney Institute for putting on this function for us. In 1953, a group of American business people gave a fabulous birthday present to Dwight D. Eisenhower, and that was an international leadership exchange program with the motto, "Leaders Bettering the World Around Them." Australia has an Eisenhower Fellow approximately every 2 years, and one of the wonderful things that the alumni all around the world get to do is on or around the 14th of October each year, we celebrate Eisenhower Day. So we couldn't quite do it on the 14th, but the 18th really has a ring to it, I think. And, you know, the 8 in it being in Asia, I think, is probably much more fortuitous. We are extremely fortuitous in lucky that Annabel Crabb was Australia's Eisenhower Fellow to the United States in 2011. We, the selection committee, did an absolutely brilliant job, and we got fabulous marks from all around the world for having Annabel represent us. And she's here tonight really giving her trip report. I think Annabel herself needs no introduction. She's the chief political writer with ABC Online, having started in Adelaide with the Advertiser, worked for the Sydney Morning Herald and also at The Age and in London as a correspondent for Fairfax. She's written several books. You see her often on TV. You hear her often on radio. And last night she was nominated for a Walkley Award. So congratulations. Tonight to talk about her topic, which was her study topic as an Eisenhower Fellow, and that's politics and the media. So please welcome Annabel.
Thank you, Meredith. Thank you, Jared. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming along tonight, and happy Eisenhower Day. I don't commemorate the birthdays of long-dead American presidents as a rule, but Dwight Eisenhower, whose birthday it was on Friday, has brought me a lot of enlightenment this year, so I will ask you briefly to indulge me while I give him a nod.
Speak up a fraction, I think.
I never ignore a Henderson demand. So in April and May this year, I travelled to the US with Eisenhower Fellowships, and many gifts were given to me over those 2 months: hospitality, insights, and the opportunity to find extraordinary new friends among the fellows from 18 other nations. But the greatest of all was the gift of time to reflect, to observe, and to think about the extraordinary changes that are tearing through the world in which I work, the media industry, and the world about which I write, politics. What follows tonight is not a travel diary. I blogged regularly, some might say interminably, from the road about many of the people I met. Dozens and dozens and dozens of them, and thanks to the immortality of the internet, all of that remains available on the drum. What follows is more of a meditation, I suppose, on the battleground that is media and politics, from someone who's been lucky enough to take a little time out from living it to think about it for a bit. Now, in Australia, there's a very hostile, scratchy feel to politics at the moment. Everyone's fed up to the back teeth with everyone else. The government doesn't understand why newspapers write crap, as the Prime Minister so pungently puts it. Newspapers respond tartly that if the government didn't dish up such crap, they wouldn't be obliged to report it. Whose fault is all of this? The 2010 election was up there with 2001 as a nasty election. It had a bad feel. For those of us working in the media, it had a chippy undertone, a mutually accusatory flavour between us, the politicians, and the public. Whose fault was it that this was such a rubbish election? It was a chicken and egg kind of argument. I, like many other commentators, wrote that the offering from the major parties was so pallid as actively to induce disengagement. How could an electorate fail to be thoroughly confused and repelled by a pair of parties that seemed intent on whittling off any policy rough edges that might otherwise serve to distinguish them one from the other? After 5 weeks in which Julia Gillard campaigned on the Coalition's immigration and border protection policies and Tony Abbott adopted Labour's line on industrial relations, is it any wonder that voters turned the House of Representatives into a bizarre kind of pantomime horse with a pair of hooves in each camp, the ears of Rob Oakeshott, the tail of Andrew Wilkie, the snout of Tony Windsor and a faint greenish tinge? Many politicians have a different view, however. One cabinet minister told me during the campaign, it's no longer possible to prosecute major reform in this country anymore. The Australian media, he told me, prevented it. What with our obsession with triviality, our tiny attention spans, our addiction to polls, our merciless gotcha mentality, and our continuing preparedness, among other things, to give Mark Latham airtime. And Lindsay Tanner agrees, more or less, over 240 pages in his recent book, Sideshow. But to understand this argument as a finger-pointing exercise between politicians and the media is to miss the point, I think quite grievously, of what's going on here. And what's going on here is a deep, elemental, structural revolution that is, for both politics and the media, a direct challenge to many of the assumptions we've hitherto made about how our jobs are done. I think the politicians versus journalist argument about standards of contemporary debate is at heart unconvincing. Why? Because no politician and no journalist is a reliable narrator on this stuff. Because we all have a dog in this fight. How can, with the greatest of respect, Lindsay Tanner ever be a reliable analyst of the manner in which the activities of his own government were reported? His book is a must-read. It's a great book. But one must also read it, remembering at all times that Lindsay Tanner's idea of optimum reporting of Tanner-related matters would differ, and this is perfectly reasonable, human nature being what it is, from that of even the most dispassionate editor. And how can any journalist, gripped by the sort of existential Weltschmerz that the present resolution has thrown up, truly be in a position to assess their own work with clear eyes? The Canberra Press Gallery has reported for decades, at a comfortable distance, on industries under which various evolutionary banana skins have been slipped. We covered the Australian automotive industry as it grappled with global trade liberalisation and the consequent removal of its protections in the form of tariffs. We've engaged in dispassionate conjecture about the sorts of retraining forestry workers could undertake. Whittling clothes pegs out of naturally fallen sassafras? Artisan cheese making? As wholesale logging staged its slow-motion collapse in the face of the sustainability argument. And now, it's happening to us. It turns out we've been operating in a protectionist paradise too. We just never thought about it that way. Just think of the monopolistic advantages we used to enjoy in the mainstream media. The possession of the means to convey information to a large audience, be it vast clanking printing presses, or the bristling array of dishes, cables, satellites, OB vans and countless other machines that go bing, on which television networks rely to make broadcasting look so deceptively easy. They generated all sorts of market advantages, those things. They cost a bomb, but it was worth it. Technology and infrastructure were our tariff walls. It was too expensive for anyone else to get involved, so our competitions were always internal. And it made life pretty predictable for politicians, too. Hell, they even helped out, restricting the number of television broadcast licences that could be issued so that existing players could get maximum value out of the protective barriers they built for themselves. As far as covering politics goes, we had a monopoly not only on the distribution of information, but also on its collection. Think about it. We had the press gallery passes that allowed us to attend press conferences and question politicians directly. We had the pigeonholes in Parliament House into which press releases and alerts as to ministerial activities were posted. We had the phone numbers. We had the seats on the prime ministerial plane. The time of ministers, prime ministers, and senators and members is a precious commodity measured out in coffee spoons to people who, for whom a government decision might signal life or death for their business, their hobby, or even their child. But we drank it up like it was our right. Interviews, briefings, dinners, we milked politicians for their time. And they gave it because we had what they needed, a nicely regulated megaphone through which their plans and ideas could become a movement, through which their thoughts could crystallise into change. Now, for politicians, for whom politics is a means of effecting change, that was a pretty good bargain. For us, who relied on exclusive content, that worked pretty well too. And the collective result was that the exchange, which we grandly called a national conversation, was actually a protected process, a fairly ignoble haggling session, truth be told, in which politicians, press secretaries, journalists, and editors bargained effectively between themselves about what subjects could and should be covered. Eisenhower famously created the idea of the military-industrial complex. Looking back on the mutually dependent, if often thorny, interrelationship between politicians and media over the last century, it's hard not to see it as a kind of politico-media complex, a closed shop of ideas. Now, every generation thinks the sun that shone on its childhood was ever thus. Like children, we compare the new to the old with a plaintive need for simplicity. Things were good then. Things were bad now. We overrate the status quo, and we worry about the future. But the truth is that democracy is a long and inexorable story about decentralisation of control over information, and we're still far from the end. When I was in the United States, I met with Professor Sam Popkin, who's the author of the US campaign Bible, The Reasoning Voter. He's written extensively on how media changes influence the political process. Professor Popkin was jailed in 1972 for refusing to answer questions at the Pentagon Papers inquiry, so he has a little skin in the game. He's also an obsessive cook, so I'm afraid our conversation suffered from very regular and quite welcome digressions into sub-relevant areas like the methods for perfecting grilled octopus. Actually, after our meeting, he remembered with alarm that he'd completely forgotten to alert me to the fact that the Shake Shack served incredible salted caramel milkshakes on a Tuesday. He mailed me a link to the Shake Shack's in-store webcam so that I could check on the length of the queue before my visit. You could say that the professor is a details man. And he did remind me of some important historical detail. When Edmund Burke made his famous 1774 speech to the electors of Bristol, he cemented the concept of representative democracy, the idea that people are better off when their representatives do as they judge best, and not always as their constituents would have them do. At that time, to be fair, the Burkean proposition was an easier one to execute, for a start. It was a criminal offence back then, even to report the goings-on of Parliament. William Pulteney, leader of the Tory opposition, had explained these arrangements thus. To print or publish the speeches of gentlemen in this House, even though they were not misrepresented, looks very much like making them accountable without doors for what they say within. Now, parliamentary sketch writers got around this difficulty with a typically devious innovation. When the young Samuel Johnson was eking out a living writing for the Gentleman's Magazine in the late 1730s, he had a spy relay to him the goings-on and debates in the House of Commons. Changing the names but keeping the characters clearly recognisable, he wrote them up in his column entitled Debates in the Senate of Lilliput. The magazine stacked on circulation as the readers cottoned on and gathered around this breach of the walls cocooning the democratic process. The American founding fathers, meanwhile, operated on the assumption that politicians and politicians alone would decide what would be reported to the American people. James Madison believed there should be no congressional record. As Popkin told me, the history of new media is an unbroken string of boundaries breached and standards challenged. When reporters started to report congressional speeches, legislators first tried to stop them, and when that failed, they developed the official congressional record containing the corrected remarks they had intended to give. President John Quincy Adams thought hired reporters, he compared them to spies, had no right to impinge on the rights of the leaders to decide what and when to report to the citizenry. What I'm trying to get across here is that Western democracy is an evolution of information control. At the beginning, politicians controlled everything. Then the media arrived as agents for the general population. And now communications technology is allowing motivated individuals to do the job themselves. In Australia, our democratic system, of course, postdates a lot of these wrangles. And we've always operated on the understanding that a free press will report on Parliament. But the status quo of the politico-media complex, which has comfortably characterised political debate in Australia for as long as anyone in this room can remember, has changed radically in the last 10 years, in the last five even. Political journalists no longer have a comprehensive monopoly over the gathering of political information. Anyone can watch press conferences. Anyone can watch Parliament. Anyone can read press releases. Anyone can read budgets, legislation, Senate reports, inquiry submissions, party platforms. Anyone can listen in online to an interview that a politician gives in Brisbane or Launceston. And on the distribution end, our infrastructure advantages are starting to look a little less advantageous. The prize invention of Johannes Gutenberg, which 550 years ago unfurled an extraordinary promise of democratisation, is these days now looking a teeny bit more trouble than it's worth. I used to file my copy for the Sydney Morning Herald at about 7 p.m, whereupon it would be checked and usually de-idioted by that newspaper's excellent subs, then whizzed off to Fairfax's squillion-dollar operation at Chullora. Here the copy was immortalised, printed in a soy and oil-based pigment on very thin sheets of sawmill offcuts and forest thinnings mushed up with a binding agent. Then my copy would be bundled into vast sheafs with everything else, popped into trucks, trundled off to newsagents and airports, and thence taken to doorsteps, coffee shops, delis, or to lie about in great piles at the Qantas Club. The early bird reader gets, perhaps at 7-ish in the morning, the very latest news available as at 7 p.m. the night before. These days I just write my copy and email it to my editor, who pops it online straight away. Maybe I tweet a link to 40,000 people on Twitter, and if any of those people read the article and think it's any good, maybe they retweet the link to their followers. And straight away, you know what your audience thinks of your work. Each reader judges whether this one article warrants a larger audience. Hundreds of retweets meant that readers thought it was worth recommending, that the article, in other words, was of sufficient interest to them to take the significant personal risk of troubling their own friends with it. When I tweet a link to an article, it's like auditioning my content to a huge gathering of editors, large and small. I'm asking them to read it. I'm asking them implicitly to consider republishing it to their readers. I'm also asking them for their opinion. And I very regularly get it. Working online has made me more reflective, more accountable, more aware of how stupid my hair is, and much, much, much better informed than I was in print. And that's not because my contacts in politics have improved. It's because I learn more from my audience than ever before. Deregulation of the old model can have profound benefits. And it can cough up some rather remarkable moments too. Several weeks ago, I was giving a speech in Sydney about communication skills in modern politics. I talked about the class of politicians that I call the manglers, joyful and heedless malapropists, whose energetic tussles with the English language keep us all enthralled. I invoked the great John Prescott, British Deputy Prime Minister under Blair, and his reported remark on arrival home after one trip abroad, that it was, quote, great to be back on terracotta, close quote. And there was a lady in the audience live-tweeting my remarks. After I sat down, she came to show me a reply she had just had from Prescott himself, asking her to tell me that the terracotta remark was an urban myth and that he had never said any such thing. He then tweeted to his followers, I just corrected an Aussie journo giving a speech in Sydney. I love Twitter. I was heartbroken over the loss of the terracotta story. But like Prezza, I love Twitter too. That old passive audience, which used to be at the receiving end, silently, of whatever survived through the selection process enforced, in the case of political news, by politicians and journalists, is a thing of the past. Now it's an active audience. They don't just read what we write. They critique it. They select it. And they are responsible in no small way for maximising or minimising the readership of any given item by tweeting a link, by liking it on Facebook, and so on. In the case of the Reddit website, they literally vote a story onto the front page. And so content is evaluated, not outlet by outlet, as it used to be, where audiences developed general impressions of which TV networks or radio stations best appealed to their tastes, but item by item. Item by item. Individual news stories do not now enjoy the protection simply of being judged by a simple single editor to be worthy of inclusion in the list of newsworthy things that happened today. More and more, readers themselves decide what's newsworthy. The monopoly on deciding what constitutes news is no longer held either by editors or by politicians. And of course, now that individual stories are left to succeed or fail on their own terms, their authors, like protective mother turtles, try to give them the best possible chance in life by making them as eye-catching and easy to read as possible. And so stories about thrilling crimes, or the broken-hearted ex-girlfriends of footballers, or action-packed accounts of political confrontations tend to dominate in the most read lists. The proliferation of new ways in which to consume news has led very naturally to the fracturing of old audiences. Genuine news junkies have no need to watch the evening news anymore, as they've been trawling news websites all day and already have more detail than a 2-minute bulletin is likely to cough up. They know genuine scoops will spread through the system smartly enough. So, shorn of these more demanding viewers, the network packages news as entertainment, because that's what tends to grab the attention of those who are not tuning in studiously to eat their veggies civic discourse-wise. This is what tends to be called dumbing down, or the coarsening of political debate. Another way to describe it, I suppose, would be democracy. And isn't that one of democracy's most annoying elements? People with whose assessments one disagrees, getting a vote anyway. The opinions of the lazy and ill-informed having just as much sway as the engaged and industrious. It's easy to draw the conclusion, almost irresistible really, that political discourse is getting stupider. But for a number of reasons, I think we should be cautious about doing that. First, I'm not sure that there's any convincing evidence that the actual proportion of people who are diligent about informing themselves on public policy issues has actually changed much. The Naked Eye tells you, and certainly Lindsay Tanner adduces much evidence to support this impression in his book, that the amount of lightweight political coverage has increased. But the amount of political coverage overall has itself increased so extraordinarily over a short period of time that one should be wary of leaping to conclusions. Access to in-depth journalism has never been better, whether it's thanks to new online entrants in specialist areas, or better access thanks to podcasting and the abolition of geographical boundaries online, to content producers working in states and countries where the reader doesn't live, or broadcasting in inconvenient timeframes. Without wanting to toot the ABC's trumpet excessively, I'm constantly surprised and excited by the work my own colleagues produce and the extent to which the internet makes it easier to find and absorb, whether it's Fran Kelly's interviews, which you can go back and catch online if you missed them earlier, or Marius Benson's relentless attentiveness on news radio, or Stephen Long's innovative economics reporting, or Mark Colvin's utterly engaging snippets and links on Twitter, or the battalions of new perspectives every day on the drum. There's depth to be found everywhere. Think tanks like the Lowy Institute with its excellent interpreter blog, or the IPA, or the CPD, or indeed my host tonight, the Sydney Institute, now function as publishers. So do universities through sites like The Conversation. Individual bloggers like Grogs Gamut lend a valuable fresh perspective to political matters, and new websites with strong readerships by area of interest, like Mamma Mia, interpret politics in a way that appeals to its readers. There are organising websites helping us to track all this stuff. It's a funny old morning in my house when I don't visit Breakfast Politics, which provides not only a daily digest of political news, but an invaluable archive and reference. If you're a foreign policy wonk, you might well complain that your area of interest doesn't warrant enough serious column space in various of the daily newspapers in Australia. But can you really argue that you have less to read now than you had 10 years ago? I think one should be careful too with the assumption that the mass audience of yesteryear was necessarily a more engaged one in the field of politics. Was there ever a merry band of Herald Sun readers eagerly drinking in page-long treatments of superannuation reform? Or has this reader revolution simply made clearer to us what was the truth all along, that lots of people always bought the paper for the sport and the telly, and not much else? Obviously not while I was working in newspapers. But, you know. Thirdly, I think we should be very careful indeed about assuming that there's only one correct way to learn about politics, and that's to sit down with a cup of coffee and Madeleine of the Australian Financial Review. Matthew Baum, an academic at the JFK School of Government with whom I met in Boston, demonstrated in his fascinating book, Soft News Goes to War, that the spread of political discussion from straight broadsheet newspapers and newscasters to magazine-style formats and celebrity-infested chat shows doesn't necessarily mean the end of serious engagement. He charted, almost as a hobby, I think, the degree of public attentiveness to the 1978 Camp David Accords between Israel and the PLO, the 1993 Oslo Accords between Israel and the PLO, and the 1995 Dayton Peace Accords between Bosnian Serbs and Muslims. Now, though more network TV stories appeared about Camp David, historically the most significant of the three, Baum found that Americans were more engaged with Dayton and Oslo. Why? Well, perhaps because Norman Schwarzkopf had done a high-profile interview about Oslo with Regis Philbin and Kathy Lee Gifford, or perhaps because Saturday Night Live ran a popular satirical series poking fun at the Dayton Accord. Soft news treatment of politics rarely satisfies purists or practitioners, but it often suits consumers who have no patience for prescriptive ideas about how they should best learn about politics. After Walter Cronkite's death in 2008, Time magazine asked online readers who they felt was now America's most trusted newscaster. 44% of respondents selected Jon Stewart, the late-night comedy channel host of The Daily Show. And yes, I did visit him. Stewart doesn't even claim to be a journalist, but his Lansing analysis is cultishly popular on the left, just as Fox News commands the right. I suspect this technological revolution doesn't change audiences so much as identify and stratify them and give each of those audiences far greater access to the sorts of things they like than they ever had before. This all sounds a bit Pollyanna-ish. Maybe it's because I'm an optimist. And maybe it's because in the end there's not much sense in arguing over something that is, thanks to the evolution of technology, singularly beyond all of our control. The market is evolving to empower the consumer, the reader, the voter. The old gatekeepers are losing control, and arguing against this progression is as pointless as arguing against the sunrise. Politicians yearn for the old ideal of a passive mass audience because that made life easier. Media proprietors yearn for the good old days too, because the same vain illusion under which politicians always lived, that is, the firm and, I suspect, erroneous sense of confidence that 100% of Sydney Morning Herald readers have just read and enjoyed the faithful news account of your excellent microeconomic reform proposals, could be spread to advertisers who went to bed at night just as restfully assured that readers were feasting on their double page spread on winter warmers. But mass audiences are not realistic anymore. How could they be? In the new environment, it's a bit insulting to think they ever will be again. In a world full of people who are so different, why would there ever be a single mass audience for any kind of news, now that the artificial barriers that once dictated one have so utterly dissolved? This is how audience fragmentation works. As viewers and readers learn how to find the stuff they like, the old gatekeepers, whose job it used to be to decide what people would or should like, are increasingly redundant. That's why all this hurts so much. redundancy always does. But as we've always glibly assured previous victims of the open market, retraining is always an option. In the media's case, it means learning how to work with smaller audiences more productively. And this isn't as sad as it sounds, bean counters. Small audiences can be immensely profitable if you know a lot about them. The new model is perhaps not all that different from the old one. An element of upfront payment and an element of hustle. In the old model, you paid a small price for the newspaper itself, and you exposed yourself in perfect good humour to the implicit risk that you might feel more like buying a fridge by the end of reading the thing. That was the hustle. Your partial attention was rented on spec to advertisers. And sometimes it worked, and most of the time it didn't. But those were the odds, and advertisers took them. These days, the upfront payment is a work in progress. The hustle, though, is a new model. Rather than surrendering your partial attention as part of the trade, you're much more likely from now on to be offering something much more valuable. Information. Perhaps you'll give your postcode, or your age, or your email address. Perhaps your use of a news website in and of itself will leave a trail of golden identity crumbs. Are you unusually interested in articles about cars? Do you pounce on items about housing prices? Or perhaps, most profitable of all, you might let on that you're expecting a baby or renovating your bathroom. These identity crumbs are the key to your profitability as a reader in the new model, I suspect. Pitching an ad at 1,000 people whom you know are likely to be in the market for a stroller might be more valuable to Mr. Bugaboo than an ad in a paper read by 200,000 people. You still pay, you just pay in different ways. Now, the United States experienced a much more savage media sector downturn than we did in the closing years of this century's first decade. And yet, everywhere I travelled in the States, there were ambitious new startups learning to serve smaller audiences better. The Voice of San Diego, one of dozens of hyperlocal news sites, which experiments with handing reporters over to answer questions posed by its readership. ProPublica, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative unit funded by philanthropists, handy, which distributes its work to other news organisations at no charge. There are entrepreneurial sites devoted to long-term... There are entrepreneurial sites devoted to long-form journalism, like The Atavist. There are open government lobby groups like the Sunlight Foundation who crowdsource valuable work on scrutiny of government. There's not enough time to run through everything I visited, but if you're prepared to step outside orthodox media formats, there's a lot going on. For politicians, though, the urgency is in the here and now, and the potential to communicate difficult arguments to a large audience. The most legitimate concern about today's fractured media marketplace is that we no longer have a town square, a place where we're all on the same page at the same time. A moment outside grand finals or particularly gripping episodes of MasterChef, at which a large chunk of Australians are all thinking about the same thing. This is a fabulously complicated problem, to which I think the only sensible answer is consistency, hard work, and the sort of innovation that we haven't thought of yet. At times, I think politicians get spooked by this freewheeling babel of media with which they tangle every day. They're worried about getting a run in the media, to the extent that getting a run becomes the aim in itself. This is a phenomenon about which Tanner writes with conviction and very chillingly. Tony Blair called the media a feral beast in his vivid speech on leaving politics in 2007. And fear of the beast is a common response among politicians forced to tangle with its ever-multiplying tentacles. Urge to conquer the beast or to sate its appetite is another. I think the Rudd government's constant, almost manic efforts to conquer the beast with constant activity, constant announcements, were ultimately quixotic. Political journalism of 50 years ago, in which a prime minister might have got round the whole country just by asking 8 favoured journos around for a fireside chat, is no more and will never return. politicians will go mad if they think they can satisfy demand in the same way these days. They still crave control of the message, some sense that they're prevailing against the beast. And I say to them on this front, abandon ship. You cannot control this, not anymore. Use the energy for something else instead, like finding ideas that you can stick to. Authenticity is a quality people will recognise no matter what medium conveys it or how many. I am out of time. I'm more than out of time. This is a subject worthy of much longer discussion. But I thank the Sydney Institute for allowing me what is, by modern standards, a very generous chunk of its supporters' attention. I thank the ABC, the most ambitious and adventurous media organisation in Australia, for allowing me to pursue these questions. I thank the Australian politicians who persist with hard work and pure hearts, despite all the obstacles evolution presents. I thank my fellow Eisenhower fellows who have given me such support over the last year. Several of them are here. Jerry Ellis, who's not here, I must say. Catherine Livingston, who's here after a reasonably busy day. Meredith Helicar, Paul Espy, Rosemary Howard, and Jenny McAllister. And above all, I thank Eisenhower Fellowships for giving one journalist the precious gift of time.
I think our speaker's tweeting secretly, is it?
I'm not tweeting, I promise.
I'd just like to say thanks to the legal firm Maddox for the use of this great facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7. There are a lot of people here, so we can keep our comments and questions brief. Just about your own predicament, you've moved from the Herald to the ABC. I mean, you mentioned advertising, but the ABC, you get taxpayers' money, so you don't need advertising. But how different is what you do now than what it was before? Because if you were at the Herald, you'd be up on the Herald website, there'd be many comments, probably some hundreds of comments, just like Andrew Bolt gets hundreds of comments on the Herald Sun website. So is it all that different? I mean, has it all changed, or has the ABC come in and moved in on what were once opinion pages, and the ABC is effectively running print online? So, I mean, how different would it be if you were at the Herald? I mean, if you tweeted tonight, they could have your stuff up on the website within 10 minutes as well if they wanted to. So how different is it to you?
I'm just going to try and adjust this thing because I've been kind of toying with it all evening. And thank you, Jared, and thank you for referring to my predicament. It's sort of rather like a Victorian euphemism for pregnancy, but... Well, I suppose that I came across to work at the ABC as an online journalist, so that meant that the rhythms of the newspaper day, which is still heavily built around that evening deadline, disappeared. So a lot of the structure of my working life disappeared, and that was actually quite challenging in the beginning because publication is what gives the news cycle its sort of 24-hour rhythm. I've found it difficult, but in the end, liberating. I end up filing at the moment when I think it's appropriate to file, and then I spend a lot more time talking to people after I've posted a piece. So I suppose that the main difference for me has been that the emphasis has shifted from publication as an end point to publication as a starting point. And that's, I think, for any journalist, a hard adjustment to make because most of us have been trained to view the dissemination of news or the dissemination of opinion either through broadcast or through newspapers as essentially a one-way movement of flawless intelligence. These days, it's very different. It's more as though you're starting a conversation with an observation and then you wait to hear what others think of it and you adjust your own views very often as a result of the responses that you get. And I think, although that can be a bit confronting at times, because hearing in real time exactly what people think of you can be very confronting on some days, you also get a lot of helpful incisive responses and opinions that are full of things that you didn't already know.
Just going on from that, the new media is wonderful, but it's very time consuming. And you talk with those who connect with you, but at what point do you get more and more into your own little inner sanctum of fans? And I heard the other day someone describing the new media scenario that confronts regular journalism as disseminating into all kinds of small, little, niche groups. And the problem now is to work out what all the little niche groups are doing as a combined thing. So to what extent does this exhaust your energies and not give you a really good idea of just how small your fan club, or not small in the numerical sense, but in terms of where it reaches beyond those who are your fan club?
How homogenous it is, yeah. That, look, that is one of the big concerns about, I think, the way that people consume media now, is that if they really just circulate among the websites that they know they agree with and talk to people with whom they know they share opinions, and then they're kind of locking themselves away into a little bubble of opinion. The idea that the great strength of curated newspapers or news bulletins in the past being that you get stuff that surprises you, you get stuff for which you weren't prepared or with which you don't necessarily agree. And I think that that's a fair enough argument. I think that is a problem, and I think that as you achieve politically stratified markets, for instance, Fox News in the US, you often find people tuning in to things that they agree with. But I also think that there is an increased, not a decrease, capacity for randomly coming across nuggets of information and enlightenment online than there's ever been, because even though we don't have but even though we're moving away from a mass audience that's kind of guided by news editors' judgments, you have all of these platforms on which you often come across sort of rogue links that people have posted on their Facebook pages or on their Twitter pages or so on. You read a story and it'll contain links to other things. I mean, we've all got lost, I think, wandering around through links that lead you to other links that lead you to other links. I think that your capacity now to find an article from 5 years ago that's thrillingly readable that you missed at the time is very much enhanced by this new world. I think that one of the problems can be that it becomes endless and that the hunger instead is to return to some sort of curation. So I think there will always be a role for curators of information. In fact, they become more important. They're just not all centralised. They're not just all anointed as the only arbiters of what constitutes news and what doesn't.
So, Robert, do you think it's ever likely that one day we'll see ministers blogging and tweeting direct from Cabinet to get around the Fourth Estate and contend with the beast that way?
Yep, I think it already happens. I don't know about from Cabinet, although I'd say that last Saturday's Herald was about as close as you get to a live tweet from Cabinet. But I mean, politicians already use those networks to get around filthy journalists. I mean, Mike Rann, the, I think, now immediately past Premier of South Australia, was notorious for it. I mean, and he worked in a one-paper town and often was having blue with the newspaper. So he'd often take to Twitter to correct something that he disagreed with in the paper. He wouldn't call the journalist, I assume, or hold a press conference. He had just tweeted. I mean, he tweeted the reshuffle of his cabinet at one point, I seem to remember. And look, this is a kind of an interesting little niche for journalists as well. And one of the strange things about this new environment, I think, is that we see more of politicians than we ever have. I mean, this is partly a result of 24-hour news, and of course the ABC came on stream recently with our 24-hour news network. We rely on politicians to fill vast yawning spaces in that broadcast schedule. We ask them to talk and talk and talk and come up with more content, as we call it, than ever before. And then we get sort of cross when it's dull, you know, or when it doesn't make any sense, or when it's so infested with jargon that you have to have a stiff drink before even tackling it. The sort of sentences that you need a machete to chop into digestible chunks. And we, I think, rather unfairly blame them for that whilst demanding that they produce ever more. I think perhaps at some point there has to be an end to it, you know. Maybe they have to stop taking us so seriously. I don't know. But, I mean, in the end, it's within a politician's own power to retreat and to concentrate their energies on introspection and on devising ideas that will be resonant no matter which medium carries them. And look, don't forget, we're in a very strange part of this process at the moment. I mean, in the argument about why the 2010 election campaign was so dreadful and why everyone's complaining about politics at the moment. I mean, I do think that during the Rudd years, there was this incredible intersection between two independently occurring but mutually very difficult circumstances. On one hand, you had a government that was very keen to feed the media cycle, very keen to sate the hunger of the beast. On the other side, you had this media that was in complete upheaval, this extraordinary state of revolution, whilst trying to work business as usual. I think that those two phenomena intermeshed in a very, very unhelpful way. I think we're all kind of working through this. It's like having renovations done while you're living in a house, you know, you have to keep living in it, but you want to try and make it better. And I think that there are plenty of people who want to do that. We just have to learn how to ride this thing first.
Right down the back, Lindsay. Yeah.
Assuming too much.
Just speak up a bit.
Assuming too much in America makes you an expert.
Terrible assumption.
Is there any, can you comment on the competing strengths and weaknesses of the American and the Australian political media?
Yep.
Is there anything we do better than they do? Is there anything they do better than
the question is about the competing strengths and weaknesses of the American and Australian media.
Well, I think there's lots of things we do better than they do. We keep out of a lot of things that they don't keep out of. And it's a really fascinating difference between the way politics is reported in this country and the way that it's reported in the United States and in the United Kingdom. In both of those countries, the assumption is that the media will report absolutely anything that it can discover about the private lives of politicians and so on. I think that we have an extremely conservative approach in this country to those issues. And, you know, I'm pretty relaxed about that. I think that in the US there's a lot of energy poured in to chasing down various ferret holes of politicians' earlier lives. I think that that has a very strong effect on the kind of people that put up their hands for political office in America. Of course, we have compulsory voting, which makes a huge difference, I think, to the tenor of the practice of politics and of the reporting of politics. I think that in America, because they had, as I said in my talk, a much more bruising experience with the sort of media downturn, they had many, many more newspapers that closed. They've had an extraordinary sort of splintering of audiences, where here I think newspaper readerships are still comparatively strong. As a result, I think they've had a lot more innovation. Partially it works because their audiences are, because they have more people to deal with. So, you know, a tiny slice of the population in America is much, much bigger and therefore much more commercially viable for any startup operation than a comparable one here. I think here we're still really only just getting over the idea that there could be alternatives to traditional media. I mean, we went through the obligatory bloggers versus journalists argument, which I think we're more or less done with now, because in the beginning there was this great paranoia about whether journalism could be replaced and so on. I think that now that argument is quite fatuous. I think that the great advantage of this new world is that there's unlimited space, and no one displaces anyone. They just compete with each other, which I think is a perfectly reasonable state of affairs.
Question down there? Yeah.
And, well, do you see a correlation between the media fragmentation, as you described it, and the fact that around the world today we have some number of very narrow majority governments
Is there a correlation between media fragmentation and the fact that in the Western world we've got a number of minority governments or close to?
Yeah. And just how do you see that evolving? And then what does that mean for business groups that are trying to work with governments, and how should they sort of evolve?
Okay, and what does that mean for business groups?
Well, I think minority governments and... Look, it's hard to say that there's a connection. I mean, instinctively, you say that you think that there is because you know, I guess historically in the West, the grounds for great political divides have kind of contracted over recent decades. Post-Cold War, there's a sense that we're running out of kind of barn door-sized issues to argue about, you know, and that's, I think, partially explains the huddling together of major political brands and so on. I think that the quickening of the news cycle absolutely panics political parties. When they are panicked into caution, they tend to huddle close to each other, and I think that that's what happened in 2010. But it's a great question about minority governments and where that leads business, because in minority governments, the stakes are higher, the certainty is lower, and the temptation, therefore, to be shriller is almost irresistible. I think that minority governments are absolutely brilliant hunting grounds for lobbyists. I think that when stakes are this close, I think business groups and other lobby groups are kind of encouraged to perhaps overstate their cases just that little bit extra in order to win the ear of whichever single vote they need to swing to convert their cause. And I think that that has a kind of echo effect to political debate as well, because a media that is, as I discussed, hungry for a sensational headline rather than a muted one will grab, I think, less questioningly onto those claims. And so the seas of a kind of extremist argument are sown. I don't think that that is... I can see why interest groups respond in that way, but where government, I guess, struggles to provide certainty, then I think other groups have to provide leadership as well, and I suspect that that may be the situation in which Australian business finds itself at the minute.
We're close to the end. Michael?
Opinions masquerading as news has been a feature of the print media. To what extent is the electronic media almost a reduction ad absurdum of that?
Well, I think there's been a huge shifting together of opinion and news in the last little bit, and it's something that a lot of people are quite uncomfortable with. Look, I'm not massively uncomfortable with it. I think that often, like so many phenomena in this area, it's a response to audiences' needs. I think that when the news cycle speeds up and we now have, as news organisations, the ability to keep you updated with news as it happens, you don't pick up your newspaper to except in the event of an incredible scoop, which, I mean, they happen regularly, so it is worth picking up your paper. It still is. More and more, I think, news organisations try to provide breaking news as quickly as it happens, and then they try to provide some context. To the extent that audiences in this kind of complete babel of information are looking for something interpretive to help them weigh up news, to fulfil that role that page placement used to fill. You know, with newspapers, I remember once when I was a journalist at the Advertiser, I went to a work function with my partner who, and someone said to me, "Isn't it incredible the way there's always exactly enough news to fill the newspaper?" And, you know, that is incredible. But, you know, page placement on newspapers is actually a very, kind of a subtle, it's something you don't really think about, but it's a kind of, it's a message about what's important and how important this is. This is a big story. Is it a page one big story, or is it a page three big story, or is it a page 10 big story, or is it a brief down the bottom of page 16 big story? No. And that gives us all of these sorts of signs that allow us to interpret our news, you know, and gauge how important it is. And I think that now that news is much more free-flowing, I think commentary kind of steps into that role. And because as a consumer of news, if you're online all the time, or if you're listening to news radio, or if you're watching News 24, sure, you can have the raw product these days. You know, you can watch every press conference that Julia Gillard gives, and that's great, but it also helps at the end to have somebody, that's why we provide them at the ABC, come in and say, well, look, here's what she said that's kind of new, here's what she said that's interesting and why. And, of course, an element of commentary comes into that because you are, by necessity, ordering news, interpreting it, offering an opinion as to why it's relevant.
Just a final question. You've now gone online, but you still write books. You've written, I think, probably, what, two books in the last 5 years. How do you see the future of the political book, the kind of book you write, in this new age that you're talking about?
Well, it's pretty good, I reckon. Partly because you can find the people who are interested in reading them so much more easily. And I think, incidentally, one thing that, I mean, of the millions of things that I looked at in the States and kind of got interested in, one of them is the ability for people to self-publish very effectively now. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's the way of the future for political books. I can think of plenty of politicians who could self-publish a book and I wouldn't necessarily rush off and buy it. But now, through devices like the Kindle, for instance, you can buy long-form journalism, pieces that run to perhaps 10,000 words, you can buy them for $2 through your Kindle or through your iPad. So this idea of, you know, quite affordable long-form works where all of that money goes to the author is, I think, an absolutely on-the-move phenomenon. And I read this great story in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was, while I was there, about a novelist whose name brilliantly, utterly escapes me, so this will be a very effective anecdote. And he was a crime writer who was up the top of the Kindle rankings for crime writing. And he had never been published in hardcovers. He started publishing on Kindle, and he charged $2 for each of his novels. And because $2 is $2, people would hear from a friend that this stuff was good, buy it for $2, read it, buy another. He was doing cracking business, you know. And I think that the ability now of audiences to talk to each other and to say, hey, this is good, you should try this out. I mean, it's easy now for people to do that in vast groups. Just as it's easy now, even though we lament the death of community and the fact that we don't talk to our neighbours anymore, there are other communities that are blossoming. All of a sudden, you're closer to somebody that you got in touch with online who lives in Nebraska and who also is interested in collecting antique harpsichords than you are to someone who lives next door to you. Now, that is an unusual turn of events. It's sad in terms of our maintenance of terrestrial communities, but it's exciting too in terms of our construction of virtual communities. And certainly I think of children who grow up in regional areas and feel isolated, perhaps alone because nobody in their area feels like them. I think that that's a very good development for people who are lonely. Anyway, now I'm thoroughly digressing, and I understand that I'm going to be chopped by Jared any minute. They can feel him bristling. So thank you very much, Jared. Thank you very much to all of you.
Lest I be chopped by Annabelle Crabb. Thanks to Mannix for the use of this facility, to Meredith Helliker, and the Eisenhower Foundation had the good sense to award a Eisenhower to Annabelle Crabb and to tell us that Annabelle Crabb had taken it, was coming back to Australia, would like to report on it, and it would be a good function to do at the Sydney Institute, as it has been. Annabelle Crabb has been here before, no doubt she'll be here again, but tonight it was a normal Crabb performance, informative, witty, and great fun. So many thanks. We'll see you back here.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.